Good evening, everyone. Good to see you here again. And so welcome back to the virtual meditation hall and to do some practice and reflection together. Let's start tonight's session with a few minutes of sitting together. So I would like to invite you to find a suitable posture for yourself. And to remember the possibility of awareness once again. Becoming aware of the body. Body, perhaps sitting here, touching the ground. The breath moving through the body. All by itself. Becoming aware of the mind, the weather system of the mind. What is the current weather in the mind like? Also becoming aware of the heart. How is the heart doing right now? Gently saying hello to the heart. Whatever it is that's currently happening in the body and in the mind and in the heart, can it be just as it is right now by itself? Letting the experience be just as it is. So on this retreat, we have been talking a lot about mindfulness or awareness. We've been practicing a lot of mindfulness. And what tends to happen with mindfulness practice is that this we start to develop, or this what starts to develop kind of by itself is this perspective of non-identification. And it's also something that we can cultivate consciously on purpose. And personally, this perspective of non-identification has been one of the really important things that I've gotten out of my years of practice. And I feel that it's so fundamentally important for the well-being of a human being that I have no idea. I just keep wondering why they don't teach it at primary school. I'm at a loss at why they don't teach it at primary school. So often we have to wait until we are adults to learn a bit more about that. And tonight I would like to devote this Dharma talk to this topic of non-identification. And if at this point you have no clue what I'm even talking about, that's completely okay. I'm going to explain everything. And if you have been following my teachings before, you know that I'm very fond of concrete examples. So I'm gonna start with a couple of concrete examples to illustrate what's going on. And they might seem a little exaggerated, which might be the case, but just to illustrate the point a little bit. So I would like to invite you to imagine this scenario where somebody is sitting, maybe you're sitting or somebody else is doing sitting meditation. And what's going on in their mind might look like this or sound like this. They might be thinking that I'm just so angry with that person. How could he possibly do that to me? That was so incredibly rude and hurtful of him. He's such an awful person. And that other thing he did just last week, how can he possibly do things like that? How can he possibly be so insensitive? So this is one scenario where somebody is doing sitting meditation. Another possible scenario where somebody is doing sitting meditation might look like this. Oh, there is anger arising in the mind. I notice that the body is tensing up. Like there's some heat and there's some pressure in the chest area and also some tingling. And the color of the anger is kind of reddish. And oh, there are some angry thoughts arising. And now there are also some angry memories arising. And there seems to be a flavor of hurt in that anger too. So this first scenario was there to try to illustrate a situation where somebody is angry and quite identified with their anger. And the second scenario was there to try to illustrate a situation where somebody is angry but not very identified with their anger, so that non-identified person would see the experience of anger from kind of a bit of a distance away and kind of from a broader perspective, have a broader perspective on what's happening. Like there's anger arising and physical sensations related to the anger arising and angry thoughts arising, angry memories that are arising. instead of just like being kind of in the anger, kind of engrossed in the anger. Another example for you, or pair of examples. So just imagining somebody doing sitting meditation, and this is what's going on for them. Oh goodness, this practice really isn't working. I'm just so hopeless at this. The mind is just wandering all the time. There are so many thoughts. I can maybe remember the breath every 10 minutes at most. And it's so very hard to sit still. I feel like getting up and running around. Like why do I always have to be so restless? I'm such a restless person, and I'm so bad at this meditation practice. I'm probably the worst meditator in on this retreat. Then the second scenario, where somebody is doing sitting meditation, and this is what's happening for them. There seems to be restlessness in the experience. There are many thoughts arising in the mind, and there's this sense of physical restlessness in the body. There's this sense of vibration all over the body, and it feels quite unpleasant, and actually there's aversion towards that unpleasantness. There seems to be self-judgment there, and now there's an impulse to get up and stop meditating, but letting go of that impulse. There seems to be comparing mind arising, comparing arising. So again, in this first situation, an example of somebody experiencing, for instance, restlessness and frustration and judging mind and comparing mind and being pretty identified with all that, kind of being in that. And in the second example, somebody experiencing the same things but not being so identified, kind of like seeing these things from a bit of a distance with broader perspective. Restlessness is arising. Judging is arising, comparing is arising. And in this first scenario, probably some practice is happening, but in the second scenario, there's more practice happening, you know, seeing with quite a lot of clarity what's arising, and it might not be pleasant. It sounds like it might be quite an unpleasant experience to be having. But what we have been saying here, that it doesn't matter what the experience is like. If your experience is unpleasant and there's, you know, self-judgment and restlessness and comparing mind, but if you're able to see it clearly with mindfulness, like in the second example, not identifying with it too much, it's like really, really great practice. It's really well done. And if we think about how non-identification might be defined, I have a quotation from Jack Kornfield, who's this American teacher, co-founder of the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in California. He has written many books, and this quotation is from his book, Bringing Home the Dharma, Awakening Right Where You Are. So Jack Kornfield writes that in non-identification, we stop taking the experience as me or mine. In non-identification, we stop taking the experience as me or mine. We see how our identification creates dependence, anxiety, and inauthenticity. In practicing non-identification, we inquire of every state, every experience, and every story, is this who I really am? We see the tentativeness of this identity. Instead of identification with this difficulty, we let go and rest in awareness itself. So identifying as taking something as me or mine and non-identification as stop taking it as me or mine. And there's an image that's sometimes used to illustrate this, and that image is that of a movie theater. So if we are in a movie theater and we are watching a movie, and sometimes we might be really engrossed in the movie, kind of forget about being in a movie theater, and we might be like crying really hard, or what we might be really scared or laughing or sweating, instead of remembering that we are actually sitting in a movie theater and it's just, you know, images on a wide screen that we are seeing. And this is not a perfect image at all. This is very far from a perfect image. You know, like if we think about living our life in a non-identified way, it doesn't mean that we are kind of looking at our life from the sidelines somehow and not really fully feeling anything, and that we are being somehow really passive. It doesn't mean any of that. So we are really able to, you know, fully live our lives and fully feel our feelings and be active participants in our life and be non-identified at the same time. Now, it's kind of tricky to try to explain this, but when you start to experience this yourself, it becomes pretty clear at that point. So there was the example of anger being identified with the anger and the angry thoughts. So if we identify with anger strongly and really believe in those angry thoughts that we are having, what often happens is that this kind of deepening spiral is created, where the angry emotion is giving rise to angry thoughts and angry memories, and those thoughts and memories give rise to even more anger, angry emotion, and angry sensations in the body. So deepening spiral of anger that's just like getting stronger and stronger. But if we are able to be with the anger in a more non-identified way, kind of like, oh, see, that anger arises, sensations arise, emotions arise, thoughts arise. We don't, you know, pour so much gas into the fire anymore, and we don't get into a spiral like that as easily. We don't kind of feed into the anger so much anymore. But of course, we are not going to be any kind of passive doormats, even if we practice non-identification. You know, if somebody has acted in a way or said something that makes us to feel hurt or angry, it might be a really good idea to bring that up with that person, to bring that topic up and see if there's anything that we could do about that. But it's a really great, like, it's great if we are able to do that from a place of, you know, balance and clarity and wisdom, instead of from a place of anger and reactivity. Another example of being identified or not is that of doubt, you know, doubting. In one's meditation practice or in a meditation retreat can take many forms, like wondering if I'm doing this right or not, should I be doing this or should I be doing that, maybe doubting the teachings, doubting the teachers, might be really, you know, useful thoughts to be having. But at some point, if there's a lot of doubting, it might turn into a hindrance, like really start being an impediment for the practice. And it was the case for me for many years that doubt was my biggest hindrance. We talk about the five hindrances, my biggest hindrance to my practice. And it was the case, that was the case because I didn't really see the doubt and I was so identified with the doubt. And for me, the doubt took the form of like wondering if I'm doing my practice right. For instance, if I was doing mental noting, you know, labeling my inner experience, I would be wondering, you know, should I do mental noting like every 2 seconds or every 3 seconds or every second? And is this what I'm experiencing right now? Is it restlessness or is it more like on the boredom side or something in between or something else completely? And I would actually spend a lot of time over many years in thoughts like this, and they would feel to me like they are very relevant and important, until one teacher for whom I'm eternally grateful for pointed out in a meeting that you seem to be experiencing a lot of doubt, which helped me to see, you know, get the perspective for the first time. This is actually not so helpful. This is an instance of doubt. And I have just been like, you know, really identified with this doubt. And after starting to see it as doubt, really helped me to get someplace else in my practice. If I ever got to decide what they teach in primary school, one thing that I would love them to teach, like right at the beginning of primary school, would be, don't believe your thoughts. Please don't believe your thoughts. Because in my experience, just like so much unnecessary suffering, this is caused by us believing in our thoughts. And there's this nice trick that you could try out if you notice a thought that causes you a lot of suffering but seems to be quite sticky. Like one example might be that I'm unlovable. Like I know some people experience this thought or this belief quite often. I'm unlovable. So you might try adding, I have a thought, in the beginning. So you might end up with, I have a thought that I'm unlovable. So in that way, that kind of brings you the perspective or the distance, helps you to not be as identified with that thought or the belief anymore. As another example, you might have the thought often that I'm gonna fail anyway, no matter what I try in life. So you might try adding, I have a thought that I will fail anyway, no matter what I will try in life. And this really brings us close to the mental noting practice that Greg has mentioned before. You know, if we did noting with the breath, we would say in or out or rising or falling. But as Greg has taught us, we could also be noting or labeling our thoughts, like remembering or planning or analyzing, for instance. And if we do that, well, first of all, it helps with the mindfulness, but it also helps with the non-identification because it does bring that distance and the perspective to the situation. We are not going to get stuck in the thinking so much, so easily, if we do that sort of a noting. So another image that used quite a lot is that of clouds in the sky. So the clouds being the different experiences we have, and the sky being the awareness. So for instance, thoughts would be clouds in the sky, moving across the sky, and emotions and mind states would also be clouds moving across the sky. And if we are able to see them that way, it also helps us to not identify so much and to remember that they are really impermanent, not taking that seriously, and not really quite insubstantial. It's amazing how much power thoughts have over us, even though they are just, you know, they are so insubstantial. There's nothing tangible or concrete about thoughts, and they might last like a fraction of a second, and still they have so much influence over us. It's just like one of the mysteries of life, how that's even possible. I just want to briefly mention one clinical application of non-identification. There's the program called MBCT, Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy. That's kind of a combination of the MBSR, Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, and Cognitive Therapy, that was developed in the 90s. And the primary intention at that time was to develop a program to prevent the relapse of depression. And research has shown that MBCT has indeed been effective in preventing the relapse of depression, especially in a population where people have had several previous depressive episodes. And so what's happening here is that we know from research that if somebody has, the more depressive episodes somebody has experienced, the more likely they are to experience yet another episode. And it seems like, well, probably almost everybody who goes through life experiences, a temporary state of sadness or low mood every now and then. But if there's somebody who has a lot of previous history of depression, and they experience a temporary low mood or sad mood, what easily happens is that, you know, some sort of depressive thoughts come up. And if you're identified with them, if you start believing in them, they are going to enhance, they are going to strengthen their sad or the depressive feeling, and kind of a downward spiral might start from there, taking you all the way down to another depressive episode. So one central piece in this MBCT program is to teach people to really not be identified with their depressive thoughts and beliefs and views so much. Of course, there are many other pieces there too, but this is one of the central pieces in that program. But I thought that I would like to share a story from you. It's a real life story about a yogi on a meditation retreat and how he encountered the teaching about non-identification and realized something about it, and how it changed his experience. And this story is from the Jack Kornfield book that I mentioned earlier, Bringing Home the Dharma, Awakening Right Where You Are. So Jack Kornfield writes that one Buddhist practitioner, David, identified himself as a failure. His life had many disappointments, and after a few years of Buddhist practice, he was disappointed by his meditation tool. He became calmer, but that was all. He was still plagued by unrelenting critical thoughts and self-judgments, leftovers from a harsh and painful past. He identified with these thoughts and his wounded history. Even the practice of compassion for himself brought little relief. Then, during a 10-day mindfulness retreat, he was inspired by the teachings on non-identification. He was touched by the stories of those who faced their demons and freed themselves. He remembered the account of the Buddha, who on the night of his enlightenment faced his own demons in the form of the armies and temptations of Mara. David decided to stay up all night and directly face his own demons. For many hours, he tried to be mindful of his breath and body. In between sittings, he took periods of walking meditation. Sounds familiar, right? At each sitting, he was washed over by familiar waves of sleepiness, body pains, and critical thoughts. Then he began to notice that each changing experience was met by one common element, awareness itself. In the middle of the night, he had an aha moment. He realized that awareness was not affected by any of these experiences, that it was open and untouched, like space itself. All his struggles, the painful feelings and thoughts, came and went without the slightest disturbance to awareness itself. Awareness became his refuge. David decided to test his realization. The meditation hall was empty, so he rolled on the floor. Awareness just noticed. He stood up, shouted, laughed, made funny animal noises. Awareness just noticed. He ran around the room. He lay down quietly. He went outside to the edge of the forest. He picked up a stone and threw it, jumped up and down, laughed, came back and sat. Awareness just noticed it all. Finding this, he felt free. He watched the sun rise softly over the hills. Then he went back to sleep for a time. And when he reawakened, his day was full of joy. Even when his doubts came back, awareness just noticed. Like the rain, his awareness allowed all things equally. It would be too rosy to end the story here. Later in the retreat, David again fell into periods of doubt, self-judgment, and depression. But now, even in the middle of it, he could recognize that it was just doubt, just judgment, just depression. He could not take it fully as his identity anymore. Awareness noticed this too, and it was silent and free. So in this story, David identified with many things, identified with, for example, the feeling or the belief of being a failure and the view of being a depressed person. But in the course of his retreat, he learned to see these as just, you know, arisings, views, beliefs, thoughts, feelings, not to be so identified with them. You know, becoming aware of the awareness, kind of the background of all those clouds, was really helpful for him in this. And when I have been looking at my own experience, you know, we could get identified with so many things. There are so many things that we could get identified with. But when I have been looking at my own experience and talking to others and reading, I have noticed that certain experiences are maybe more common or more painful if we identify with them. And I just wanted to mention a few more here. What David was experiencing, that belief that I'm a failure, in my experience, it seems to be reasonably common too. Or for some people, it might be I'm worthless, might be that belief that they deep down identify with. It feels like somehow really true deep down. Another one is, I'm different. You know, I'm different. Okay, everybody is different from each other, but I'm more different. Would be sometime interesting to see how many people actually experience this one. It might be quite a few feeling that they are really very more different than anybody else. I don't belong is another painful one. Or I'm not good enough. I'm not as good as the others. I'm not as good as I should be. And shame is a really, really painful emotion that usually has a lot of identification in there. So shame as the feeling of there's something deeply wrong with me. And you know, if you deep down feel that there's something deeply wrong with me, you're not gonna want to talk about that with anybody else. You're not gonna want to share that with others. You don't want anybody to know about that. And the thing is that if you don't share, if you don't do anything about that, it's just going to be stuck there and you just are going to keep believing it and being identified with that because it's never going to get questioned. It's never going to get challenged. So it's one of the really challenging ones, shame. And I once read in a book by Brené Brown, an American author and so sociologist, I believe. I haven't seen the original research, but she writes in one of her books that shame has a strong connection to aggression, addictions, depression, bullying, eating disorders. So much of shame and identification can cause us. And yeah, just like thinking about identification more generally, the things that it can cause us, so many, you know, kind of like closing the windows of the mind, being so identified with something and losing all perspective and, you know, tensing up of the body-mind system and kind of losing the connection with the world and the others. And I've spent quite a lot of time talking about being identified with emotions and certain thoughts like beliefs and views. But there are many other things that we can be identified with too. Like yesterday in his talk, Greg talked about the body and mentioned that so often we identify with the body instead of seeing the body as not mine, not me, instead of seeing the body as nature. And many, many aspects of this, like one that comes to mind is that, like, some of us might be more identified with how our body looks than the others, than some others. And this is just an imaginary example of somebody who might be really, you know, young and beautiful or handsome. And if they are strongly identified with how they look, like, this is me looking like this, this is who I am. When that changes, that's gonna lead to so much suffering. There might be an accident or there might be aging, just simple aging happening. But the looks are gonna change and then there's gonna be so much suffering. What happened? I'm not like this, I should be like that. Another aspect of this not me, not mine perspective to the body is what Greg talked about, that if we really, you know, owned the body, if it was really, you know, somehow mine, there was somebody to own and there was something to own, to be owned, then I suppose we would be in control. We would get to decide what happens in the body and what is experienced in the body, but it's really not like that at all, as we have noticed. I don't get to decide that I'm gonna feel happy and pleasant right now, or I'm not gonna get any more wrinkles or gray hair. For some reason, I don't get to decide any of that. So, some other experiences that we might identify with are, you know, the experience of me here, you know, me here, you know, I'm the one who's listening to a Dharma talk, or I'm the one who's looking at the screen, or I'm the one who's having these thoughts, or I'm the one who owns this body, or I'm the one who has control over this body, I'm the one who gets to decide how to move the body, or I'm the one who owns this computer, or I'm the one who owns this apartment, or I'm the one who has this life history, or I'm the one who has this partner, or whatever, like these different variations of the sense of self we so easily identify with. Is it possible to remember that this sense of self is just another experience? You know, we might experience coldness in the hand or the humming of the computer or some fluttering in the stomach, or the sense of self. It's just another experience, like all the others, comes and goes, nothing too substantial there. And if we really get to see that, we maybe stop taking ourselves quite as seriously, maybe get some more lightness, freedom in our experience. And maybe lastly to mention that it's of course possible to identify with the awareness itself, like, this is my awareness, or I am this awareness. Just one more example of this. And to conclude the talk by another quote by Jack Kornfield, who says, Buddhism calls non-identification the abode of the awakening. Without identification, we can live with care. Yet we are no longer bound by the fears and illusions of the small sense of self. We see the secret beauty behind all that we meet. And I would like to, for the remaining 10 or so minutes of this session, to invite you to try this out in practice. Try some non-identification with me. So if you'd like, you could you get yourself to a nice meditation posture to do this practice with me. Allowing the eyes to close and feeling into the body. Feeling the legs. Feeling the hips. The stomach and the chest. The lower back and the upper back. Feeling the shoulders and the arms and the hands. Feeling the neck and the head. Feeling the entirety of the body. The life of the body. Also feeling the landscape of the mind, the weather in the mind. Becoming aware of the contents of the mind. And finding the anger that you have been using, having the anger be part of your experience. Having the anger there but allowing for a wider field of changing experience. The practice that I'm going to introduce next is not something to think about. It's not something to analyze. So I'm going to invite you to drop a few words in your mind And just see what arises. The idea is not to think about what they mean or anything else, just dropping them into the mind and seeing what arises, what kind of a reaction arises in the body and in the mind. It's like dropping a pebble in a pond and just witnessing what kind of circles form on the surface of the pond. Dropping a pebble in a pond, as simple as that, not thinking about the pebble. So whatever your experience is right now, might be anything, whatever it is, try dropping these words into your mind. Not me, not mine, not who I am. And again, seeing what the experience is right now could be the same as before, could be different. The most predominant experience for you right now, feeling that, and saying to yourself, not me, not mine, not who I am. So you could repeat this practice for the remainder of this meditation period. Feel into the experience and drop in those words and just see what happens, what arises by itself. this experience here, not me, not mine, not who I am.
Thank you.